I'm Kathleen Dunn on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Our guest this hour wrote recently, last month, one of my friends told me she was making $70,000 as a waitress at a fancy restaurant. She quit because she didn't find it satisfying and took a pay cut to work as a community organizer. Voulet, our guest, said he wept softly into his soy hot chocolate. $70,000 was way more than he was making as the head of a nonprofit, and he had rapidly graying hair and daily night terrors. Most people in nonprofits don't go into the field because they're going to make a lot of money, but he says that there are too many nonprofits that just aren't doing a great job at determining salaries and paying their staff fairly. We've developed, he writes, some no-good, very bad habits. Voulet is our guest. He is executive director of Rainier Valley Corps. He's a humor columnist as well, and he has some interesting things to say about what it is nonprofits should do to set salary levels, to figure out how they are determined, and to perhaps offer some benefits to employees so they don't burn out, which many of them do. I know that many of you listening work with nonprofits or have worked with nonprofits, so he will be speaking to you, and we'd like for you to speak to us to tell us what your experience has been. Do you think nonprofit organizations have been undervalued? What can nonprofits do to recruit young people to compete with the corporate sector? We welcome your phone calls for Voulet. Our phone number is 800-486-8655. This group that he started is a startup nonprofit, and their mission is to cultivate leaders for ethnic-led nonprofits and to also create space for communities to collaborate to achieve change. He's a humor columnist for the online magazine Blue Avocado, and he writes about nonprofit culture at his website. And Voulet, thank you very much for being with us. Hi.
Thank you, Kathleen, for having me.
Yeah, nice to have you here. So tell me why you decided to go into the field of nonprofit.
Actually, I was pre-med.
Really?
I think a lot of us kids who are immigrants and refugees, we are pushed by our parents to go into the fields of law or medicine. And so I was going to be a doctor, which made my parents pretty happy. But then I decided we probably had enough of the kids going to these fields, and we don't have enough counselors and social workers. And so I decided to go and get my master's in social work.
You could have been a rich man, Voulet.
Yeah, but I didn't really want to be rich and at 70 and then, you know, look back at my life and wish that I had done something else. I feel like nonprofit is, you know, it doesn't pay very well, and I think we need to change that, but it is rewarding in lots of other ways.
Mm-hmm. And certainly it attracts a certain kind of person, and I guess you could say the mission that many have is to do good work, right? To do good in society.
Yeah. I feel like lots of people get attracted to the sector because they do want to do something good for society.
Do you find, though, that because it doesn't pay very well, that we are having a hard time attracting particularly young people into the nonprofit field?
I think yes and no. So we do have some very idealistic young leaders who are coming into the field, and they're motivated. We have a new generation of, I think people are calling them millennials, who are idealistic and optimistic, and they want to go and do something meaningful with their lives, and so they do that. On the other hand, I think because of the salaries are so low, the ones who do enter the field may not necessarily stay in the field, and so I feel like, you know, we attract people with this idealism, this optimism, and then they go into the field. And then it becomes very frustrating, all the systems that we have to deal with, the fundraising, the funding dynamics,
mm-hmm.
The fact that we are not paid well, the fact that society does not really understand nonprofits necessarily or appreciate the work that nonprofit professionals are doing.
And then, as you write, we do-gooders get older and start thinking about a family, and you start pining for things. This made me laugh, although it isn't really funny. Like a decent used car with brakes and mufflers that actually work.
So I drive this Honda Accord that has 250,000 miles on it.
Oh, my gosh.
And it was really hot in Seattle, and my headlights was duct taped on because it had been broken. And then with the heat, it started melting off, and now it just kind of flopped over to one side. And unfortunately, this is actually not unusual for many of my peers in the field. We drive crappy cars. We go to a lot of meetings. We collect these paperwork, and then we shove them into the back of our crappy car. And I just had a baby recently, and I thought, oh man, I can't have this crappy car that could explode with me and my baby in it at any time. So now I'm trying to find a new used car. But you know, this is the type of stuff that we go through. I feel like many of us can. Society expects us to martyr ourselves and drive crappy cars and give up, you know, nice things as part of the work and part of the archetype of being a nonprofit professional, and I think we really need to change those.
Yeah. So that's part of the historical and societal norms that you're doing good work, you're doing it for the good of everybody, you can sacrifice your well-being because don't worry about you. It's not about you. It's about a larger good.
Yeah, but I think it's extremely short-sighted for society because we're talking about short-term and we're talking about long-term investments. And in the short term, that might work, that we expect people to sacrifice. But in the long term, it doesn't really work because we're not given the resources and the tools and the authority to address some of the most endemic and entrenched problems that our society is dealing with.
Let's center for a moment here on the issue of salaries. Is it just that it's so hard to do fundraising and so most nonprofits don't have the available funds to pay their employees, or what is it?
That's definitely a huge part, I think, is the funding dynamics and the funding structure that we have to work with. So we have funders who provide one-year restricted grants, and then, you know, so we're just constantly trying to find ways to survive. We try to Frankenstein different sources of funds together to keep our organization afloat. So organizations are spending a lot of their time actually just trying to find these funds, these grants, and cultivate relationships with donors. And on top of that, there's still all these restrictions of what we can actually do with the funds that we do get. Some funders will say, yeah, I'll pay for the computers in your program, but I'm not going to pay for staff to run those programs. Or we'll pay for transportation for your programs, but we won't pay for food for the kids in your program.
Mm-hmm.
Government funders especially are extremely restrictive. They won't, you know, they may not pay for taxes, for your, you know, payroll and stuff. So all those things, I think, add up to the fact that, you know, we're just constantly focusing on survival and actually not thinking about how we can move our nonprofit up to, you know, to the next level of actually expanding and deepening the impact that we have on our community.
And what about the available money for those grants? Is that a shrinking pool or an expanding pool?
I think it's been shrinking somewhat, I think, from my perspective. And the economy has been impacting how much funders have been given. But I don't know. I think it's more than just how much funding is available. I think it's again this sort of mentality of the funder-fundee dynamics and relationship. It's always been, you know, adversarial almost. It's kind of like the legal system. I kind of feel like, you know, we have these lawyers who are arguing on different sides, and in nonprofit, we actually have a very adversarial sort of system. I feel like people are not trying to perpetuate this necessarily, but I think that's what's happening. We have, you know, nonprofits that are trying to do work on the ground, and then we have funders who are, like, way above in a different level, and oftentimes we cannot speak with them. So we're always on opposite sides of the table, and I'm often wondering why are we on opposite sides of the table? We're all trying to address the same issues.
Right. Yeah, and let's talk about the people who are in nonprofits. You talk, and I think this is really valid, before we get into salaries and how they're decided, But this whole thing of taking in new people and then even interns and teaching them about the field that other places like Microsoft, that I believe you mentioned, and some other companies are just terrific about doing that, that they take people in and they learn the business and the ins and the outs, and it may make them want to work for the company at some point. Whereas with nonprofits, it's kind of a hit or miss situation, and you don't have as many interns to groom people to go into the field.
Yeah, that requires funding and resources. Someone has to coordinate these programs, and so our field does not have that. We don't have kids thinking about going and interning at nonprofits. We don't have nonprofits approaching schools and providing presentations about the benefits of going to the nonprofit field. And so we just kind of hope and pray that kids somehow discover nonprofit work. And our society and our media doesn't really portray nonprofits in the best light or any light at all, really, if you think about it. There's a few archetypes on TV. There's like the CPS worker who takes people away, who takes kids away from their parents. Or whenever there's a nonprofit, it's usually on like Law and Order, and they're selling internal organs in their basement or something.
Oh, no.
We're not selling internal organs. I think only 10% of us nonprofits actually sell internal organs.
Right. I think it's that's maybe high, right? What about in terms of just employment? Do you feel, and do a lot of people in nonprofits feel, that they can't really count on long-term employment with the place they are? Because the funding is so sporadic, or do you feel that you've got a career here that could last your whole life?
I think for me, I would love a career that lasts my whole life. But I think the reality for many of us who enter into the field is that funding is completely unstable, and so many of our positions are grant-funded, and they are 1 year in duration. So we try to do our best work, and then we just, by the end, by the halfway point, we're just hoping and praying that there's some funding that comes through,
right,
and we start thinking about fundraising to keep our position, which I think is really, really sad and alarming, because it takes like a year to be good at your job, to understand what it is. And then after a year, that position goes away, and we have to scramble again to try to find something. And then all the experience leaves, and then our clients are left wondering what happened with the relationships they built with these staff. I think it can be very, very frustrating.
Mm-hmm. All right, let's move into salaries here for a moment. You, in a piece you recently wrote, said that we need to stop relying on intuition to set salary levels. Is that really what happens? It's intuition?
I've worked at a few nonprofits, and oftentimes, yeah.
Really?
Yeah, absolutely. So a lot of the factors that go into how you determine nonprofit salaries is oftentimes not really clear, because they're so unstable. You think about, okay, what grants am I going to get this year? Is my annual dinner going to pull in enough money? So we just kind of budget almost on faith on a lot of these positions. So then we just determine, okay, well, this fund is going to pay this much, and I can raise the rest of this. So, okay, you know, and Mars is in Pisces or whatever it is. And so, yeah, we're going to set this position at this level. And I think that's not good. We need to stop doing that.
How should it be done?
We need to look at the industry averages. I think a lot of regions, lots of cities do wages and benefits surveys of nonprofits. And we can pull those reports and look at, okay, my organization at this certain level, how does that compare to the average for the rest of that sector in this particular geographic location? And what is the average for this particular position? I feel like we need to start with some basic averages and information about the salaries that we're setting.
Mm-hmm. You also, jumping to the end of your recommendations, but sometimes to attract people, it's nice to offer some unusual benefits. I like the example of, in the summertime, one nonprofit you know of said, let's knock off early on Friday afternoon so you can have a little bit longer a weekend to be with your families.
Nonprofit professionals work really hard. I mean, there's really not a 9-to-5 nonprofit job, because we're constantly thinking about things. We're always worrying about where, you know, funding is going to come
right
from. And then we have clients who might call us at hours outside of our work hours. So we're always thinking and working and answering emails all the time. So, and then we don't get paid enough to do it oftentimes. So I think having some additional benefits would be helpful. I think one advantage of being in the nonprofit field is you work for a really great nonprofit. It tends to be very flexible. You know, you can work whatever hours you want as long as it adds up to 60 or 70 hours a week. And you can. So there are advantages, and I think that nonprofits should take advantage of the flexibility and allow their staff some leeway to be able to flex their hours, spend more time with their family, take a longer vacation if necessary to recharge and come back renewed. Mm-hmm. I think those things are important. Yeah.
What about the salary of the executive director, people like you? How should that be determined, and how much higher can it be than everybody else?
I don't really have an exact formula for this. I mean, the ED, there's a lot of burden that goes on the ED's shoulders. So I think, again, looking at the averages in terms of the wages and benefits for that particular section or geographic area, I think would be really good. But I really think we need to move society away from this whole, you know, EDs and we're making too much sort of thing. First of all, I don't think any of us are making that much. We're talking about, you know, some EDs of really large national organizations are making 400,000, 800,000 or whatever, but those tend to be rare, first of all. And if we look at it, if we look at, you know, the CEOs of the company, a CEO who might be making, you know, violent video games or yoga pants or whatever, or celebrities or athletes, they're making millions and no one bats an eye. But we're making $80,000, $100,000 to help end homelessness,
right,
or cancer or poverty, and people are having an issue with that. I think society's priorities really need to change.
Voulet is our guest this hour, and we'll be welcoming phone calls for him. He's executive director of the Rainier Valley Corps. He's also a humor columnist, and a piece that he wrote, "All Right, You Guys, We Need to Talk About Nonprofit Salaries," caught our eye, so we thought we would have him on the show. A couple areas we're talking about. I'm sure that some of you listening are in nonprofit fields. What attracted you to those fields? Do you see a shrinking or expanding amount of money to keep your nonprofit going? Are there enough young people who are entering the fields to keep it going for a long period of time? How do you determine what the salary levels are going to be? Is it just pretty willy-nilly? Should there be a more thoughtful process, and if so, what should that be to determine what it is people can get paid? Can you offer other kinds of benefits? Our guest recommends planning to bring salaries up to industry averages. We'll talk more about that. Staff awesomeness and pay test, which is interesting. We'll talk about that as well and more. Voulet is our guest, and here is how you reach us. 800-486-8655. 800-486-8655. Our email is talk@WPR.org. Facebook page is The Kathleen Dunn Show, and we're also on Twitter. You can reach us at K Dunn Show. Tomorrow at this time, author Tom Shachtman will join us to talk about his new book, chronicling how science and experimentation were at the heart of the founding fathers' philosophies and actions. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Voulet, our guest this hour, we're talking about nonprofits and welcoming your phone calls. Again, here is how you can reach us. It's 800-486-8655. 800-486-8655. The email is talk@WPR.org. Our Facebook page is The Kathleen Dunn Show. And we start with James in Madison. Hi, James.
Well, good morning or good afternoon.
Hi.
So I wanted to make a comment. I'm a former Rotary president, and I'm an entrepreneur. And one of the key notions that I've had over the last few years with all the different nonprofits that come and speak with our club is that so few of them have an entrepreneurial model, i.e. a philanthropic generator that's making money for them, for their charity, for their entity while they sleep. And I often correlate it with somebody who's looking for a date with some very, very attractive individual who's broke, drives a crappy car, is thrice divorced, and wants somebody else to buy them dinner. I think that the notion of having an entrepreneurial model that that brings income into the organization can't help but help them be more successful and no longer have to beg with the tin cup. I sense that when you have enough money to drive not only the executive director, but the other staff, et cetera, you will find staff to be tenured, and you'll find a higher level of expertise beyond just the newcomers that make their way through the mill.
Yeah. And James, can you give us an idea of what that entrepreneurial model looks like? Have you seen that in action somewhere?
Well, there are a number, and of course, a lot of Rotary clubs do this, and there are a lot of different potential models out there, but the model that I'm most interested in driving as a former president is the model of utilizing e-commerce to fill some sort of need, and utilizing that e-commerce model where you don't have to have a brick-and-mortar investment. There's still investment, but it's not a lot. And as long as you found the need and you make people well aware that the need is being fostered by your charitable organization, which is going to make a certain percentage of that populace lean toward your operation as opposed to a purely commercial venture, that has the prospect and the potential to drive basically an economic generator for charitables. And I think we see this upsurge in entrepreneurialism through the United States. As we speak, we see a lot of it in Madison.
Uh-huh.
And I have this really strong belief that we're at the cusp of a place where charitables literally can do that. A simple example is a bratwurst stand that the South Madison Rotary does at the football games, if you've been to one. And they spread their word. They also, of course, spread a lot of bratwurst all over the place, although that particular model requires them to do the work. That's a fine thing, but I do believe that as far as a philanthropic generator goes, that generator is best to utilize fulfillment. In other words, a commercial entity that might make the widgets or send out the materials or whatever it might be, such that charitable organization isn't spending all their time making widgets mm-hmm. or holding out the tin cup, but spending their time actually doing the things that they're passionate about.
Mm. All right. Voulet.
Yeah, well, thank you, James. First of all, I completely agree with you. No one wants to date someone who is thrice divorced and driving a crappy car with a tin cup. I think you have some valid points that we do really need to change the philosophy and the image that we present as nonprofit professionals. We are, you know, we are professionals. We definitely, and I think we need to take pride in that. And we need to stop being so scrappy all the time and project this aura of constantly striving to survive. What I would say is that it's become a societal issue. It's not just the nonprofits that are, you know, providing this sort of image. It's the entire society and the history of nonprofit work and how it's been evolving or not. So I think in one hand, we ourselves have to take charge and change our image and our perceptions, or no one's going to want to date us. But the other thing is that I think it's really more complicated than that. You know, I feel like there's definite funding challenges, and I know right now that the entrepreneurial, the B corporation, the earned income models are popular, and everyone's talking about sustainability. Funders are always constantly asking us about how to become sustainable. But I think the reality is most of us are thinking about these ventures. It's just that they are very challenging. I believe that about 95% of them will fail, or even if they do succeed, it's not going to be able to succeed enough to actually hire the staff to require to run these organizations. Plus, some of the work that we're trying to do, working with abused children, for example, or the homeless, it's going to be very hard to be able to do all that work, which I think you call making widgets, and then also trying to raise the funds and manage a business at
right.
the same time.
Yeah, very, very hard to do both. Thank you, James, for your call. Julie in Duluth, hi.
Hi.
Hi, Julie.
Thank you for having me on the show. I would like to invite your guests to come and visit us in the Duluth Superior area. For one thing, Minnesota has a wonderful statewide organization, the Minnesota Council of Nonprofits. And at the University of Wisconsin in Superior, we have a Northwoods Nonprofits Institute that helps do capacity building work for nonprofits. And we have a very healthy nonprofit sector up here. Many people employed. Not everybody makes a lot of money doing it, but I think everybody makes enough money to keep them in the field and are visible and good, well-developed professionals doing good work. I wouldn't disagree with the statement about funding. It's always a challenge, but, you know, I've worked with and for nonprofit organizations for 10 years, and what I have frequently seen to be the problem is that individuals, particularly in smaller nonprofits, are so focused on and passionate about the work that they don't really want to focus on the governance part and the fundraising part that's
right.
important to keep organizations stable. So it's not different from small businesses in that way, but I think there is a vibrant, healthy nonprofit sector. I would agree with him about trying to hire people in at too low a wages, having a 25-year-old daughter who's been trying to work in the nonprofit field and can't do it without having a second job.
Mm-hmm. Boulay.
Yeah, I would love to come and visit Minnesota.
Where are you, Boulay? What state are you in?
I'm in Seattle.
Oh, okay. Washington. Okay.
Yeah. I think you're completely right. Many nonprofits are not focusing enough on their capacity and building their board, their strategic plan, their marketing. But I think the challenge has been systemic. I feel like many funders, for example, do not invest in capacity building. It takes a lot of funding and staff time to be able to get, you know, everything up and running. And unfortunately, many funders do not fund that because they consider it not directly benefiting clients. Like many funders just won't fund admin costs or fundraising costs. And the capacity, one of the things that we really need, for example, is fundraising capacity, which requires full-time staff to develop the individual donors and write the grants and things. But who is going to pay for that? Many funders just refuse to pay for these indirect staff who are really critical to doing the work.
Mm-hmm.
So, and then we have many funders who just provide very small amounts of funding of $5,000 to do a strategic plan, for example. But that's not enough because who is there to implement once that plan is made? Many nonprofits just don't have the staffing or staff time to implement the capacity building strategies.
So what do you do? What's been your experience if you don't have the staff to do? Obviously, funding is crucial here. What kind of arrangement do you put together?
I think one is we have to change the system. I think we have to be able to provide feedback to funders, for example. We are so terrified of giving feedback to funders. And I think a lot of funders are actually good at taking feedback. They would welcome it. But because of the funding dynamics, we always feel like, you know, we're terrified of speaking to funders and giving them feedback because it might impact how much they give to our organization and to our sector. So then we start perpetuating things. For example, many of us have an annual event, and we have an ask, and we ask people to raise their paddle to give money. And we always say things like 100% of your funds go to program costs, you know,
right?
Which is terrible because that all that does right. is says, you know, that program costs are great and everything else is not good.
Mm-hmm.
So we start perpetuating these mm-hmm. messages that we dislike.
Thank you, Julie, very much, and good luck to your daughter. Maybe she needs to go to Seattle. Is the nonprofit field better in Seattle, Willay, or not?
I think it is. I think
is
we
it?
Have lots of progressive people here in Seattle, but and we have many funders here, but I think there's still lots of challenges here.
Ruth in Madison, hello.
Hi. Well, I'm going to have to be a little bit vague, I'm sorry, but I used to serve on the board, I served two consecutive terms on the board of a national nonprofit agency. And I was the representative from the AFL-CIO on that board, and I replaced another person who had served like six consecutive terms, but I was the last one on that board. And, you know, when we would go for our monthly meeting of the labor body, of the central labor body, like the South Central Federation of Labor kind of thing, we get to the part of the agenda for reports of members to representatives on other boards and committees. And I would get up and I would report on the board that I was on, except that I could not report on anything the board was actually doing. No specifics, because there's confidentiality involved, too, you know. But I could say they're doing really good things. And that, and so then, as people are taking their notes and reporting back to their members at what happened at this central body meeting, they would say, "Well, Ruth reported on the her on the this and that board, and reported that they're doing good work, and you know whatever." And so, or reported that there's going to be a project to law, you know, whatever. And then the labor community would get this word out, you know, through the grapevine, that volunteers were needed for this or that, or whatever. Now, we got a CEO that was hired who sort of was thought a lot more of herself than she probably should have, and she had a certain salary, which was not small. But then all of a sudden, the nonprofit had to get a really nice car for her. I mean, I think it was a Mercedes.
Oh my gosh!
And had to be leased for her. Oh no! I'm sorry. It was something that she used outside of the business too. So it was a big truck of some kind. And then she also wasn't satisfied with the desk in her office. And so next thing you know, there's this $22,000 inlaid desk. Now, the board was never told about this. I heard about it through the employees, you know, because of being on the labor body. And they're saying, well, you have any idea about this? So I, of course, went to the head of the board and said what I said. Well, you know, and told what this was looking like to our community, the labor community. And that person was not CEO for very much longer, and I don't know if it was because of that or because of other dissatisfactions that they had or disagreements or whatever. But along with her going, when my term expired, there was no AFL-CIO representative replaced on that board. And I don't think that they've done as well because of that. And so have you thought about putting people on your board that can reach into the community and do the invisible work and do the invisible publicity for free?
Boulay?
Yeah, so do you still have that desk? Because I need a new desk.
I have no idea what they did with it. I really don't know.
Maybe they auctioned it off. At $22,000 desk.
Okay, right, you could do that.
Or, you know, make sure that we're not scrappy and that we're well, that we are fairly paid. But I think you just got, that was just a bad deal. You got the wrong person for
that's for sure.
Yeah, so I think the board has to have some safeguards in place. For example, approving the budget and then anything that is varying by 10% or whatever needs to be gain board approval. She can't just, Edie just cannot be spending things willy-nilly. So I'm sorry that happened. That seems really terrible.
I would imagine that's not happening at all at the level that most nonprofits operate, because they just don't have that kind of money to buy a desk like that, right?
No. We certainly would not. If we had $22,000, no, we would not buy a desk with that.
What about the importance of the boards, how they're selected, what authority they may have, Voulet?
The board is really critical. I'm really appreciative of people who serve on boards. I mean, these are people who have full-time jobs, and they're also giving up their time and expertise and money to these organizations. I think we need to do a much better job supporting our boards so they can be more effective. And I've seen lots of boards that are just not effective. And I think oftentimes it's because we're so focused on the work that we don't spend enough time, you know, getting to know our board members, getting to know them one-on-one, spending time with them, figuring out what it is that they can contribute and what they're interested in doing. So
So I think we, all of us in nonprofit, need to start doing more of that with our board. Because when the board is really effective and you get the right people and the right combination of people and skills on the board, they do amazing things for the organization.
And thank you, Ruth, so much for your call. Jack in Shawano, hi.
Good afternoon. Thank you for the program and for the call. I'd like to follow segue with what your speaker had to say regarding feedback. I've been contacted by mail by four probably national wild animal shelter organizations with four-page solicitations generally for each contact. This spring, I decided to write to them on their request form, asking them two questions to respond to. One, what national organization that rates nonprofits has rated your organization, if any? And two, what kind of monies go to your programs for animals, feed, shelter, and what have you? None of the four have ever responded to my request, and two of them have subsequently contacted me by mail after my request to them, and no response. And I'd just like to know what your speaker thinks about accountability of nonprofits.
All right.
Again, I think it needs to go back to the systemic issues that we're dealing with. The charity navigators, their systems for ranking, they don't have a standardized way. They're just looking at how much money we're spending on program versus admin versus fundraising, which I think is a very ineffective way to rate how much good nonprofits are doing. So how it's like you buy a cake, and instead of figuring out how much, you know, or how good the cake is when you eat it, you figure out, oh, how much are they spending on electricity in baking this cake. I think the bottom line should be how good the cake is, or how effective the organizations are at serving their clients. So I think this sort of how much are we spending on admin costs versus program is a red herring, and it's very distracting from us actually doing any sort of work. So, you know, I use this metaphor of the cake again, of us as being bakers of a bakery. And then the funders are customers. They come in and they say, well, I want to buy a cake for, you know, a certain group of people. And we say, great, you know, we bake cakes. We're great. And the funder says, well, I can only give you 20%. So you have to find the 80% elsewhere. And we say, all right, we'll find some other customers to buy this cake. And then the customers say, oh, great. Well, with my $20, you can only buy 3 eggs, and you can't spend it on your electricity. You can't spend it on the rent or your baker's salary. And so then they come back a week later and say, this cake is not good. What's going on? I'm not going to invest in you anymore. And we say, well, we have 4 or 5 other customers, each one having their own restrictions. And so we spend so much time trying to figure out who is paying for what instead of spending money on baking the best cake that serves the most people. And so now, you know, we have people saying, well, we need to ask them how much, you know, did they get a national charity rater to rate how much they spent on electricity on this cake? And I think that it's just not a good way to measure how effective nonprofits are doing. There's no standardized way also to measure admin costs. Some people measure different things. There's no standardized way. So these measurements are all ridiculous and ineffective.
Thank you, Jack, for the call. We'll take more in a moment. We're talking about nonprofits. What attracts people to the field? Are we attracting enough people? How they're getting money? How people are paid? Why it is that they are paid too low? And we have yet to move to, and I promise we'll do that in a moment. How do you decide salaries and raises for your employees? We'll talk about that in a moment. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. We sure did want to thank you to all of you who contributed during our fall membership drive. We had more than 6,800 listeners pledge, including almost 1,800 sustaining pledges. Pleased to welcome over 1,800 new members to WPR. You donated over $744,000 to fund Wisconsin Public Radio, and we thank you very, very much. This hour, we're talking about nonprofits, and our guest is Vu Lay. He is executive director of Rainier Valley Corps. He's a humor columnist as well, and we're talking about the nonprofit industry. Let's talk about salaries for a moment. You have suggested that organizations create a uniform set of rules for how the organization determines salaries and raises. Is that something that's not commonly done, and who should be involved in setting those rules?
It's definitely not commonly done. I think with some of the bigger nonprofits, they will have, you know, a chart of different grades and how much experience and all this stuff where you can actually kind of see with your experience how much you should be getting paid, and it's very clear. But I think for the majority of nonprofits, we don't have that. So we go on by intuition, and I think that this causes a lot of challenges. So then it's about relationship, and it's about how much funding is available or is projected to be, which I don't think is very good for planning for growth. And so we have lots of staff who are underpaid and other staff who are way more underpaid than other staff, and it seems to be very unfair, and I think we need to be more systematic about it.
Mm-hmm. And are there people who are worth more than others, and is it fair to give them more money?
I think it should be about, I wouldn't say it's worth more. I definitely feel like people should think about their roles and the responsibilities that they have and how much work that they will have to do for the organization to be successful, and they should be paid to get those results. So, yeah.
Let's go to Guy in Milwaukee. Hi.
Good afternoon.
Hi, Guy.
Hello. Hi, I was just online. I was trying to find this.
Are you there?
Sorry.
Yeah,
I'm here. I had another call. I apologize.
Yeah, don't take another call when you're on the radio.
I wasn't able to find it, but I recall hearing a story, and I thought it was possibly on Here on Earth or This American Life, about this guy running a for-profit fundraising company, and he talked about how he took a $45,000 budget for an AIDS walk and turned it into about $700,000. And it just kind of made me wonder about the whole model for fundraising for nonprofits and a lot of the things you're talking about today. And I wish I had a name or a specific source to hook you up with, but I don't.
I would say, yeah, we definitely need to change the way we go about fundraising and marketing. We're not allowed to market. You know, we don't see many nonprofit ads on TV, because people would find those to be frivolous. But we're talking about some really entrenched problems here, you know. But then if we spend money on fundraising and ads, then again, as in with the previous caller, Jack, mentioned, you know, people start looking at how much you're spending in terms of fundraising and marketing versus how much you're spending on program. But if you can take $45,000 and turn it into $700,000, maybe $45,000 is 50% of your admin cost for that year, but it managed to raise $700,000. So a funder who is only caring about how much your admin costs are and that they are low will look at that and say, oh, you spend $45,000 out of your $50,000 budget. That's like almost all of your budget on just admin and fundraising. Well, we're not going to invest in you, even though you raised $700,000. So I think we definitely need to change the system and the philosophy around admin costs and marketing and fundraising and the things that we need to do to do our job.
Mm-hmm. Thanks so much, Guy, for the call. Our number, and we have some lines open. We're talking about nonprofits this hour and welcoming phone calls for Voulet 8. Our number is 800-486-8655, 800-486-8655. Email talk at WPR.org. Facebook page is the Kathleen Dunn Show. I haven't really had a chance, Voulet, to ask about your current nonprofit. What are you doing?
Yeah, my current nonprofit is called Rainier Valley Corps, and it's trying to basically develop the capacity of ethnic nonprofits and also train up the next generation of immigrants and refugee executive directors of nonprofits, because not many of us immigrants and refugee people go into the nonprofit field because our cultures don't necessarily encourage that. And so we don't. We go into other fields, and then the ones who do defy our family's wishes, usually, such as me, we go into the field. Oftentimes, we can't find work, we can't find the support that we need, and we don't necessarily have the experience and the connections to navigate the
the nonprofit system, which can be very difficult to break into. So, and then we have all these ethnic nonprofits that are just built, they don't know how to do fundraising, they don't know how to do grant writing, they do some amazing work, but they do not know how to grant write and do the strategic plan, develop their board, et cetera.
Mm-hmm.
So what we do, what Rainier Valley Corps does, is we take these emerging leaders who want to go into the field, and we train them and provide them with a mentorship. Then we place them to work full-time at these ethnic-led nonprofits.
Mm.
They work full-time to develop that nonprofit's capacity.
Mm.
So they both develop the capacity and experience.
Mm-hmm. And what is your family background?
I was born in Vietnam.
You were?
Yeah, and I came over here when I was 8. Yeah.
And other members of your family are in the for-profit field? Or are there others who have followed in your footsteps, Fule?
No one has followed my footsteps.
No.
Pretty crazy right now.
Nobody.
No one. My brother went to real estate. He's doing pretty well for himself right now. And we're like fire and water. He thinks I'm just all bunnies and unicorns trying to help the world, and I think he's just, you know, ridiculous. So it makes very awkward Thanksgiving dinners.
But you have the same background. So you have good memories, too, I'm sure, and difficult ones, too. Kimberly in Madison, our next caller. Hi, Kimberly.
Hi, how are you?
All right, how are you?
Hey, good. I'm sorry I'm catching the tail end of this hour. I actually work for the Better Business Bureau of Wisconsin. We are a member-supported nonprofit, and I've spent my career in for-profit and nonprofit, and I think that there is something about working for a mission instead of just a paycheck that
mm-hmm.
is that extra perk for your, you know, for what you make and really coming home and feeling satisfied about what good you're doing in the world and all that. But you were talking about fundraising, and I just wanted to mention, you know, there are a lot of sources online for donors to check, and there's Charity Navigator, there's the Better Business Bureau has give.org. You can actually look up a charity and find out how much of your donation will go to their actual programming and mission. So if you're going to give a dollar and 90 cents of that dollar goes to fundraising, you know, then at least you can make that decision, okay? Do I mm-hmm. want just 10 cents to go to feeding the animals at the shelter, or would I like to give to another one? So I guess I'll just take my response off the air, but I just thought, you know, it's of course, the Better Business Bureau is all about letting consumers make good decisions, but it's, you know, it's getting that information out there, and I would love more nonprofits and more charities to actually be more transparent.
Thank you so much, Kimberly.
I would completely disagree with Kimberly, and I think we should not be looking at these ratings at all, because, again, as I mentioned, they are not standardized. We can't really compare from one organization to another. It's all self-reported. So one organization could have a really amazing treasurer and accountant who can, you know, play around with the numbers and allocate things differently versus another nonprofit who may not have that experience. So in which case, if we're just self-reporting, then there is really no validity to many of these rankings. So at the end, we really need to focus on what the organization is doing and whether they're serving people, not how much they're spending on the dollar versus admin costs and fundraising costs, et cetera. We need to get away from that.
So who should be assessing how the good work that a nonprofit is doing?
The nonprofits, the clients, the board members. I don't really have a clear suggestion for this, but whatever we're doing right now, which is ranking nonprofits based on how much they're spending, is like, again, rating a cake on how much the baker used in terms of electricity to bake that cake.
Mm-hmm.
And it's not effective. And the Better Business Bureau Wise Giving Alliance, I looked them up, and you can get a little seal. You can apply and get a seal, but you have to put it on your website that says that you're doing whatever, you fall in line with their guidelines. But you got to pay like $1,000 to $30,000 depending on your salary to get this seal, which I think is not effective. It's like they're rating you on how well you're spending money, but you're buying this seal I find that to be very ironic.
All right. I'm sorry we can't carry this on further, but Kimberly, thanks for the call. And Voulet, we're out of time. Thank you so much for being with us this hour.
Thank you so much, Kathleen, for mentioning nonprofitwithballs.com. I really enjoyed this.
Thank you. Voulet, Executive Director of Rainier Valley Corps, our guest, and we thank him. Thanks to KP Whaley for producing the hour, to Lisa Nalbandian for on-air production. David K. Johnston, a fabulous economist, is with us the first hour of tomorrow's program. And hour two, we'll be speaking with Thomas Shackman about how science and experimentation were at the heart of the Founding Fathers' philosophies and also their actions. So those shows are coming up tomorrow. Thank you very much for listening to us today.